Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Dr. Susan Hawthorne. She's an Australian radical ecofeminist lesbian. She joined the Women's Liberation Movement in 1973 and it changed her life for the better. She's a poet, novelist, and feminist theorist with degrees in philosophy, ancient Greek, Sanskrit, and a PhD in women's studies / political science. She's the author of 9 collections of poetry, 3 works of fiction, and 4 nonfiction books. Her books have been translated into 5 languages. She's worked in publishing for more than 30 years and is an adjunct professor in the School of Humanities at James Cook University in Townsville. She lives in tropical Queensland, surrounded by wildlife, cassowaries, goannas, wallabies, lots of butterflies, and lush vegetation. So first, thank you for your work in the world, and second, thank you for being on the program.
Thanks, Derek. It's great to be here.
So a central point of your work, and especially your book Wild Politics, seems to be about the importance of biodiversity. So can you talk about biodiversity, what you mean by that, and then at some point contrast that with sort of the bogus notion of diversity that's being promoted these days?
Well, biodiversity is a complex, self-sustaining system of an ecological niche in a very particular locale. And the reason why I say that is because biodiversity is not something that you can homogenize. It is something that occurs in particular place, particular time, according to the conditions, the ecological conditions, environmental conditions of that place. And the other thing about it is that it's very difficult, although the World Bank has tried it, to appropriate biodiversity, because it's actually made up of a whole lot of things that aren't easily controlled. And once you change one bit, you change the rest. So I actually think that biodiversity is important as a reality, because it's important for the survival of the planet, and it's really important for the survival of different ecological niches everywhere. So within my own locale, for example, at the moment, the cassowaries are wandering around looking for the particular fruits, little blue fruits, that they love. And those fruits go through the cassowary. The cassowary then poops it out, and that helps to sustain the tropical rainforest. But I think it's also conceptually important, because it makes us think about context, and the specific context of when things happen, why things happen, and that's, again, I mean, it's in really stark contrast to neoliberalism, which is a homogenizing, one-size-fits-all kind of ideology. So for me, for those sorts of reasons, biodiversity became really important to me when I was writing my book, Wild Politics. And in fact, it became more and more central. The more I thought about it, the more central it became. So it was interesting, because it's the last word of the subtitle, but in fact, it's really, you know, in some ways the most important part of the book.
So before we talk about the other diversity, can you say, so what the heck does biodiversity have to do with feminism? What the heck is ecofeminism anyway?
Well, you know, feminism is a big picture philosophy. It is a politics that is connected to particular locations in the same way that biodiversity is. I mean, the problem with patriarchy is that it has homogenized all women, and usually there are only two options. There's the whore and there's the Madonna. And, you know, so there are only two kinds of women that you can be. Hardly any of us actually fit into those stereotypes. When you think about the whole range of different women around the world in all through all time. So for me, feminism is a really important part of that. And I think for the other thing is that It's actually impossible for me to separate feminism and ecology because both of them really just have to go together. Because what happens when something is bad for the earth, it's bad for women. When something is bad for women, it's bad for the earth. And there are many analogies that you can run just in terms of, you know, Andre Collard's book, The Rape of the Wild, for example. I think the analogy of the rape of the earth and the rape of women at crisis level for both of them, is very clear to me. And so I think that I don't think you can be a feminist without thinking about the environment. And while sadly, some environmentalists don't think about women, they really need to in order to make, environmental thinking workable. Because if they're not thinking about the way in which women are treated on this planet, then it's a big problem. It's part of the patriarchal mindset.
And what would you say is the patriarchal mindset that that joins those different atrocities or analogous atrocities together of the rape of women and the rape of the wild? What is the patriarchal?
The patriarchal mindset is that the earth is a resource and women are a resource, and to be used in whatever way for whatever the consequences. And it comes out of a sense of entitlement where men on the whole think about, and I'm thinking men with patriarchal mindsets. I know there are exceptions, but, you know, we have to make some generalizations. The patriarchal mindset is one that is inconsequential. That is, the consequences simply don't matter. There's a sense of that entitlement in which a man thinks that he is owed the earth or he's owed this woman. And one of the really fine examples I came across was a baron some centuries ago talking about the battalions of forests. So well before neoliberalism, this baron wanted to knock down the wild forests and plant them in straight lines and turn them into battalions. So these whole connections between the destruction of the earth, militarism, inconsequential thinking, and a sense of entitlement, I think apply both to the way the earth is treated and to the way in which women are treated.
And would you say that, you know, you said perceiving others as resources is a part of the problem. Would you say that's at least somewhat close to the core? And what does that mean to perceive, like, women are what sort of resource? Does that mean perceiving women as orifices? Does that mean perceiving women as primarily the carriers of my seed to, you know, I'm the king and then they're going to bear my son, the next king? Or how does that mean, how do you mean resources?
Well, it's all of those things, as you say, but it is the sense in which, women are there to provide for men. So, whether it's, the provision of sexual services or the provision of food and caring and emotional support and general ego building up, all of those kinds of things, as well as the provision of children in a more conservative society. But even in lefty circles, there are still there's still exploitation of women and an assumption that women will provide and, on the whole, that they will do it for free, just like the earth.
So I completely agree with you And can we tease out, okay, in any relationship, there are going to be certain, expectations and certain roles. I'm thinking about this ecologically too, that mm-hmm. one of the functions that the little fruit provides, one of the services, God, I hate using this, but I'm trying to sort of make my way through it. So the cassowary sees food and eats the food, and then at the same time, the plant is seeing the cassowary as, oh, here's a way to carry my babies away and spread, well, literally spread my seeds. And I'm completely agreeing with you, but how do we, what is the distinction between, oh, maybe it, does it have to do with what you said about consequences, inconsequentialism?
Yes, it does. And as well as that, the thing is that the cassowary and the tree are in a relationship with one another that supports one another. So they don't then demand, the cassowaries don't demand that the tree drops all its fruit at the one time so it can gobble them all up now. And nor does the tree have a particular expectation that the cassowary will plant those seeds in particular places. You know, it's that sort of thing. And it's a reciprocal relationship. And I think that becomes very, it's a cyclical, reciprocal relationship that enables both parties to thrive.
So this sort of takes us to a central, one of my favorite chapters in your book was the chapter about our relationship to land. And can you talk about the different perceptions of land between land as in a sort of patriarchal perspective? The chapter is called Land as Relationships and Land as Possession. And in some ways that says it all, but can you make that clear for people? Because I think the notion of owning land is so central to the dominant culture. And of course we can talk about the notion of owning women. We can talk about the notion of owning non-humans. I mean, that's central to everything too.
Well, I got very excited also in writing, about this because it's something that's very close to my heart. And as an Australian, we have been learning from Indigenous Aboriginal peoples from all over Australia about this. And I've been working with Aboriginal women, particularly since about the 1980s, and have learned an enormous amount in that time. And the thing is that for an Aboriginal person, the land has that, often Aboriginal people talk about sacred sites. Now, sacred sites are places, they're like Notre Dame cathedrals, let's say, from a Western perspective. They are important places which should not be disturbed. They should not be bulldozed. If they have trees in them, those trees should not be knocked down, etc., etc. And the thing is that those sacred sites are often very important places for food gathering, for medicinal products, or for celebratory events like a corroboree. Or there might be a river. It might be associated with a river or a rock form or a cave. You know, a whole lot of things like that are actually really important for the survival of people in a pre-colonized Australia, which is a very different place. and the spiritual life of Aboriginal people is exceptional and very important to them. I started to see that there were similar connections because I've studied Greek and ancient Greek. I've read a lot about Greek myths and so forth, and I started to see similar things about sacred places in the ancient Greek world. You know, a place like Delphi is just full of important sites that are go back thousands and thousands of years and have important sacred but also medicinal and survival and shelter uses. So the thing is that a sacred site becomes critical to the survival of Indigenous peoples. It is part of the relationship to the land. The stories that are told create another layer of relationship. And you can't actually own that. The stories are passed down and then they are passed down again and again and again. So it is something, but nobody ever actually owns the land. The people have rights to a particular area. They also have responsibilities. So all in within the Australian Aboriginal context, rights and responsibilities go very closely together. So relationship is central to the ways in which many Indigenous peoples around the world connect to land. They don't sell it. You know, they pass on responsibilities to it. And that really started to change in post-industrial Europe, because Europe before that also had a sort of collective ownership of land. There were common areas. Many of the forests were common areas. The rivers were. So you could go down to the river and get a fish and survive and, you know, whereas these days the rivers tend to be owned, certainly in America. In fact, that really shocked me when I first went to the US and I saw fences along the rivers, because in Australia any area that's within 3 metres of the high water mark is common land and you can walk along it, whereas in the US you can't. So to go back to the, and then in terms of the connection between women and land, in Nurundjeri culture, which is a culture from South Australia, and Spinifex published a book about that called Nurundjeri Wurrawarrin, The World That Is, Was and Will Be. And in that, Dyer Bell writes about the connection between the word for land, rui, and the word for body, rua. So again, you're getting these kinds of interesting connections coming up between land and body, relationships, and in that particular period when Diane Bell was writing the book, there was a bridge being built across a river. Now the women, the Nurundjeri women said, if you build this bridge, we will get sick. And in fact they did. And one of the main women activists, one of the leaders, finished up dying of stomach cancer, because they felt that putting the pylons of the bridge into the earth was an invasion of their bodies. And this is something that they had a story that these two places that were being connected by a bridge should not be connected in any way, that the river needed to flow easily, and these two were separate land places. So there are all sorts of complicated things going on there. But for me, the connection between land as relationship and the other side of it, land as possession, and then also going back to women and land is very, very important. And these days, if you've got enough money, you can buy land without even knowing where it is. That, I think, is the ultimate in disconnection in terms of land as possession.
What you were saying about the connection between land and body reminded me of Years ago, I talked to a Maori man who was telling me that he was pretty appalled by the fact that our words in English for soil and dirt are associated with unclean. You know, something is dirty, and you know the clothes are soiled. And I don't remember for sure, but I'm pretty sure that he was telling me that that there was some relationship in Maori between the word for earth and the word for placenta. And don't quote me on that last part, because I'm not sure that's correct, but I remember specifically the first part about how that would lead to such disrespect of, you know, if your very words for the earth are the physical earth are the words for things being soiled and dirty, then that's obviously going to affect us on a pretty profound scale.
Yes, yes, and it has an impact just in terms of how our minds work. You know, we disconnect. Yes, and I agree. To have something that is soiled sounds terrible, but the soil is a wonderful place, and it is filled with so many organisms. And when it gets decimated, then there's no biodiversity left. So you know, it all goes around in circles.
So. Let's circle back to the beginning and talk about diversity. There's a phrase someone taught me a long time ago, which is toxic mimic, which is where something will take the form of something good or important and then pervert the content to be something the opposite. And how a lot of times, I'm connecting this with something else that is where when you have, since the earth is the source of all life, if your ideology or patriarchy, your life system is disconnected from the earth, it has to gain its energy from somewhere. And one of the ways it does that is through these toxic mimics. And is there anywhere you'd want to go with that, including the notion of diversity versus a real diversity?
Well, there are many different ways of going off from that. But one is that I noticed that the right wing generally does not have any original ideas. On the whole, what they do is they take an idea from somebody they despise, they appropriate it, then they distort it, so they turn it into a sort of fake version. And then, because it's a capitalist system, they then sell it back to us and make it look like we need to buy it from them, and that it was their idea, and that they're now going to make money from it. And this gets particularly so where you see biotechnological so-called advances, where some company comes along and they create something like a fast-growing tree, for example. They want to do this because the trees don't grow fast enough for the forestry industry. And the problem is that it doesn't really work. And, in fact, it becomes a failure. But that failure in itself actually is the origin of a new business idea. You see this very, very strongly in the reproductive technology industries. And recently, just the last few days, there was something about taking cells out of the bodies of women who are in their 20s. So, and so delaying menopause, as if anybody wants menopause to be delayed. And then making it possible for them to get pregnant at a later age, in their 50s, say. Now, this is a new way of making lots and lots of money for the medical industry, the pharmaceutical industry, doctors, IVF clinics, and the rest. And, of course, it's women's bodies that are being used. But it will fail. But when they fail, they'll come up with something else. And the IVF industry is full of failures and new business opportunities.
Just to be clear, since I haven't heard of that before, they take cells from women in their 20s, and then do they hold these cells for 30 years? And then
Yes, and then they put them back. But there's no guarantee that it'll work. Of course, they know it won't work. But in the meantime, they make a lot of money. They charge $10,000 to take these cells out of a woman. Now, why would you want to do that?
And how many 56-year-old women want to have a child at 56? That means when the kid's a teenager, you're going to be 70.
Yeah, I know. It's crazy. It's absolutely crazy. But, you know, that's the way the people's brains go. That's what the philosophies take you towards.
I think as a teenager, I aged my mom, you know, over that 7 years, I aged my mom about 20 years. So, and I think that's not atypical. My mom would not have had the energy to deal with a teenager when she was 70. And my mom had tremendous energy. Oh my gosh, that's so scary on so many levels. And I mean, that takes us also back to resourcification and to everything you've been talking about so far is context. And you're actually removing the cells from the context of a 26-year-old woman, you, not you, them, and then putting them into a 56-year-old woman. And that also makes me think of the whole, surrogacy question, which I've interviewed some people about, and that's the same thing. It's renting a womb. It's using the woman's body for other people's purposes.
Indeed, and not just other people's purposes, but generally for the purposes of very rich white people. And it's so crazy. And the women who are surrogates, so-called, they're abused. They are abused by the use of particular kinds of drugs that they need to take in order for it to work. They get abused by being disallowed from living an ordinary life. They have to be pregnant for 9 months, and then they finish up having to give up the child. Now, we've had a huge problem here in Australia with the stolen generation. First of Aboriginal children, and then of the forced removal through adoption in the 1970s of single mothers. And yet, here they are having a system that puts that directly in place. It makes it inevitable that this woman has to give up her child.
So here's you talked about the failures in IVF, and I think if we're going to talk about failures, and you want to talk about failures by refusing to acknowledge context, we have ecological failures. I mean, there has never been a dam that's been put on a river that hasn't harmed the river. And
yes,
there has never been a forest that has been industrially managed that has not been harmed. And so how did you grow to understand the importance of context? And how many failures of context through the refusal to acknowledge context do we as a culture have to, I was going to say perceive, but honestly, I don't think most people perceive them before a larger portion of people will understand the importance of context. I'm sorry about muddling this question up so badly, but I think you understand what I'm getting at, or I hope you do.
I do. I mean, first of all, I think growing up on a farm in a fairly rural, remote area has given me a sort of underlying understanding of how the natural world works. I was also lucky to have parents who considered the environment, even back in the 1950s. And my mother, for example, insisted that there be trees in the paddocks where the sheep were because they needed shade. So things like that, I think, have contributed to my thinking. But I've also been lucky to interact with people from many different places. And the book actually started when I went to a conference in Bangladesh in 1993, and I began to see how different the agricultural world in Bangladesh was from the agricultural world in which I'd grown up, even though I had decent, ecologically minded parents. In Bangladesh, they, first of all, it's a much more fertile place, but the way in which they use the farms and the particular people we were traveling with, Farida Akhtar, who has the most amazing organizations where they work with farmers, they work with spinners, they work with women in a whole range of different places. They have music schools and all of these things come together. But the conference that I went to, we sat around, there were about 65 of us, I think, and we sat around for several days thinking about all of these issues. And so that then plays into other things that have come, which is, you know, the crisis of climate change, for example. And we're seeing that very, very vividly here with the Great Barrier Reef, which is in a terrible, terrible state. And people have been talking about it for decades. Charlie Veron, who's perhaps the best known coral scientist in the world, has been saying this for decades and nobody is listening, least of all the government and industry. And it's very hard, particularly the coal industry, who would just destroy the earth if they could dig it all up and burn it. And in the meantime, you know, the Great Barrier Reef, which is the largest natural thing in the entire world, a living thing, is falling apart because of the temperatures of the water. The water temperature here is sometimes almost the same as my body temperature at the edge of the sea, which is horrifying. I'm being a bit rambly here, but the thing is that all of these things play in, and one of the difficulties is that so many people are disconnected from the natural world these days. Well, you know, I'm not sort of suggesting that we go back to an idyllic paradise, but a little bit more knowledge would be certainly helpful, and an understanding of context. So children, for example, in primary schools could be learning about the natural world around them, even if it's only their playground in New York. I've seen fabulous examples of wild spaces in urban areas and urban gardens, and what a difference it makes for people if they can have a garden, get involved in growing veggies, or even if they won't grow veggies, grow flowers, grow whatever. It really makes a difference to people. And I know that it makes a difference to me being able to be connected to the land and connected to the world around me. And that applied even when I was in the city. So it's not just that I now live in a rural area, but it is important, I think.
So I keep thinking about context, and I keep thinking about the hole that patriarchy has dug and the sort of depth to which the decontextualization of everything goes. And I'm thinking of, like, I think four examples here real quick. One of them is, one of the lessons of pornography is that, you know, women are orifices, and it decontextualizes not only sex from an interpersonal relationship of any sort, but also decontextualizes the particular body parts. So it separates women. I love Jane Caputi's stuff about how, women's body parts are chopped up by surgeons, and they're chopped up by serial killers, and they're chopped up by pornography and advertising, which is my second one, which is the use of women's body parts to sell cars or to sell something. And then the third thing I'm thinking is zoos. And I'm thinking about how one of the terrible lessons of zoos is that you can put a cassowary in a cage and you still have a cassowary. And I think that's the fundamental lesson it teaches, is that this creature, you know, is separate from, I mean, the cassowary really is the seeds it eats, and then the seeds it poops, and it's the entire community. And then the fourth thing I'm thinking, and then I'll shut up, sorry for me rambling now, that I'm thinking about science, and my first degree was in physics, and I mean, science is a very powerful way to learn things, but one of the ways you learn things is by experimentation, that you take something, you remove all the variables except one, that's the whole point of doing an experiment, and then you learn whether when you do this one thing, this one other thing happens, and then you generalize that back to the world, and so by definition, you've taken everything out of context. Yeah. So I'm just saying this in terms of, and then, you know, like you said, humans in the city have been removed from our context, and yeah, we can still find a context, and there are still butterflies who live in cities, and there are still ants who crawl on the sidewalk, and there are still various plants pushing up through the sidewalks. I'm done rambling. So again, sorry, I'm dumping all this on you, and now you can take it wherever you want.
Well, it's interesting because in a way that's what I would have liked to have come back to, but I've lost my own train of thought. And yes, the whole thing about the porn industry is decontextualizing. And if you were to approach the idea, and I'm being a bit, it's a bit of a thought experiment, of pornography from a context sensitive point of view, you wouldn't do anything. You simply would not do anything. You could not. Because the purpose of pornography is to dehumanize, is to objectify, is to make the woman into a commodity. And advertising is clearly about making things into commodities or people. And zoos are a bit the same. And, you know, science is being sold to us all the time. So I think that there are very many comparable things there. But the whole thing about context sensitivity also then takes us back to the idea of biodiversity, because biodiversity and context sensitivity are really, in a sense, one and the same thing. If you are going to be context sensitive in a particular environment, then you are going to be thinking about biodiversity. And if things get out of balance and a particular plant or insect starts to take over, then it means that something has gone awry. But the thing is, there's interesting things about, I read an article in the last few days about spiders and how they help, even though they're predators, how they actually help to maintain biodiversity, because the grasshoppers react to them. They don't want to be gotten at by a spider, and so they shift to a different plant that actually helps to keep the grasslands healthier. So, and we have the same thing here in Australia about dingoes. Dingoes have been hunted almost to extinction, not quite. But dingoes actually perform a very important role in maintaining the health of a particular environment, because they, you know, they will eat a kangaroo, but because some kangaroos get taken out, then there aren't these huge explosions of kangaroos who then decimate the grasslands, you know. So there's really important things. And also, I used to have a dog who was half dingo, and she was just the most amazing creature I've ever met.
I was going to go a different direction, but you can't just leave that. How so?
She knew exactly what to do in any particular situation. So, for example, if she saw a snake, and we sometimes have snakes hanging off our eaves, instead of leaping at it, she would step back and sit and watch. She knew what to do. And in fact, we used to have somebody who came in and we have a small pool, and had a long blue thing to empty the stuff out. At first she thought that was a snake, and so she reacted the same way. She would step back and not do anything. So she knew what to do. Whereas my previous dog, who was a Kelpie, the first thing she did was she would leap at a snake. We tested this out with a snake skin. And that was her first reaction, was to leap at this snake skin, whereas the half dingo dog knew that this was not something that you did. So she was connected to the context in a very interesting way.
So we have about 7 or 8 minutes left, and I'll ask you some sort of wind down question in a minute, but I've kept saying, so let's talk about diversity as the bogus diversity of, instead of biodiversity, but then we've kept putting it off with all these other interesting things. So can you talk about that for a couple minutes before we start to wind down?
Sure. Diversity is really, really big in the publishing industry right now. Everybody says, we've got to get diversity into our lists, or we've got to have diverse people working in publishing. The problem is, I mean, the thing is, we've been around almost 30 years. We were doing diversity in that sense, even prior to setting up a publishing house. And what these multinationals who do diversity think is that if they get a black woman and a disabled woman and somebody from another country writing books, then they've done it. And so they give lots and lots of promo to these three people, but they actually don't do anything more than that. And the same is happening in, you know, corporate culture, which is going, oh, diversity, diversity. On the gender scale, it's gone completely nuts. And on a whole lot of other scales, they actually don't mean it. It is just a phase. And soon they will get over it and they will move on to the next big thing. When I was thinking about diversity, although I write a lot about it, in terms of culture, what I started to talk about was multiversity. But, you know, even that, and that just means, you know, there are multiple worlds. And then the other thing is that they are getting things like sensitivity readers. Now, a sensitivity reader is nothing more than than somebody who has a particular agenda. And any sensible editor, if they didn't understand a particular thing in an author's book and was a culture that they perhaps didn't know about, they would get a reader to look at it. So, you know what I mean? It's gone crazy and it's become a kind of, inverted commas, policy. But the people working in publishing are still nearly all white, are still nearly all middle class, and actually most are women because women are cheaper to employ. And, you know, really, it's a beat up.
And here's part of my problem with it, is that we can have, it's great to have female reporters, so don't get me wrong on that, that's great. But you can have a female reporter reporting from, I don't know, Morocco, and that's great. I don't have a problem with that, except in the background, everybody is still driving trucks. Mm-hmm. And you still have, the point is that this is, for me, sort of a superficial diversity, when what the sort of diversity that the Earth requires would be that people living in Morocco are not driving trucks made in Japan or the United States, for that matter. It's because that's that homogenization. And besides which, we're watching television. which is a great homogenizer. This sort of horrifies me that over the last 50 years, there have been some studies about, in the United States at least, how a lot of dialects and accents are disappearing because of the homogenization of television. And then in addition, then that doesn't even lead to, or doesn't even take us to, the real diversity that's lost, that, as you know, indigenous languages are disappearing more quickly than indigenous than native species even.
Yes.
And that is a tremendous loss. I mean, that's the real diversity that every indigenous person I've ever spoken with about language has, every single one of them has said, our language came from the land. And
yes,
that ties back to everything about what you were saying about context, that if you lose the language to speak about the context, you have lost one way to immerse yourself in that context.
Yeah, we've actually just published a book called Karu, Growing Up Gurindji, which is in English and Gurindji is an indigenous language from the Northern Territory. And it's about traditional child-rearing practices in the Northern Territory. And it is fabulous. And it is so interesting because of these connections between language and life and context.
And you have said several times about being in publishing. We have about 3 minutes left, so can you divide that between telling us about the specific publishing company and then also wrapping up this context when we have a conversation with somebody sitting in the Redwood Rainforest talking to somebody in the Australian Rainforest?
Well, I, along with Renata Klein, we founded Spinifex Press, which is a radical feminist publishing house here in Australia. We've been around almost 30 years. We publish radical feminist books. We publish controversial and innovative writing. But an important part of what we do is we also create optimistic texts. We don't want to just leave people sitting in a quagmire of misery. But also we noticed before we set up the publishing house, we noticed that postmodernism was starting to take over any kind of feminist publishing, and people who had perfectly fabulous writing careers beforehand simply weren't able to find publishers anymore. So basically we have provided a home for many writers, many radical feminist writers, lesbians, Aboriginal, migrant women, older women, you know, working class women. We've done all of that, and we've done that for nearly 30 years. And I did check whether we had done this kind of range of things in the first few years just several months ago, and we were. So this is something that is part of our DNA, let's say, as a publisher. And I mean, beyond that, we've published also lots of books around ecology and war and globalization, and you know, anyway, you can actually find us if you go to spinifexpress.com.au. Don't forget the AU at the end, because otherwise you won't find us.
And so give us about a minute on, you've talked about this a little bit, but can you give us like a minute more on how, God, this is a terrible question, how individuals can re-understand context? And it's a terrible question because I use the word individual. But
well, first of all, I would say join a collective. or go and talk with other people of like-minded perception, and just talk about what's happening around you and what's right about it and what's wrong about it and whether it's possible to do anything about it. That's how the women's movement started. It started by women joining consciousness-raising groups, talking to one another. Gradually, the penny starts to drop. I remember I was in consciousness-raising groups in the early 1970s, and it made a huge difference to how I viewed the world. And, you know, because we all have our own particular mindset and background, it's really valuable to hear other people's stories. And for me, that was other women's stories about the things that they faced in growing up. Simple things like, my brother got all the attention. You know, that kind of stuff. And you eventually realize it's not about you. It's not, you are not the only person struggling with this. And I think the moment that you cease to see that you as an individual are the center of the world is a very important moment. And I think we can all do that by talking to one another, but also by reading, by joining activist groups, by getting involved in a whole range of different things, even just by gardening. It's a very fine pastime. You learn a lot. I've learned a lot from the vines, for example, around here. I've learned that some vines cling really hard to the tree. Others release, but they grow back really quickly. So there are interesting things to be found in many places.
Well, thank you so much for all that. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Susan Hawthorne, author of many books, including Wild Politics, Feminism, Globalization, Biodiversity. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.